You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks, and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter. This panel session was part of Brexit Britain, an afternoon of debate and discussion produced by BBC Newsnight in partnership with Intelligence Squared at the Royal Geographical Society in London.
Very warm welcome to you.
Literally.
As George Galloway would say, I admire your indefatigability in coming here today. I hope you enjoy it and you find it stimulating. We at Newsnight are not event organisers as such, and we partnered with Intelligence Squared, who've done a great job at assisting us with the construction of this day. Now, I just want to know a little bit about the audience, so I'm sure do our panel. There's only one question that matters, isn't there? How many of you voted Remain? Right. How many of you voted Brexit? I said it's going to be 80. I said it's going to break 80-20 for Remain. I'm going to call that, what, 90-10, do we think? 90-10. Okay. I may ask that question again when we're on air. So stick to what your things are. Stick to your views. We don't want you changing. Yeah, so like at question time, the audience is normally constructed to be more balanced. But this was a paying event in West London, and it's not typical of the entire nation. Now, our first session, ladies and gentlemen, is essentially, we're not going to discuss Norway or Switzerland or Article 50. We're not going to discuss Theresa May. We're not going to discuss the state of the Labour Party. This first session is, what have we learned about our country out of this referendum and the campaign that went before it? Okay, what have we learned about our country and its divisions? We have a great panel who I will introduce, and I'm going to get them to talk for 2 minutes each on something we've learned about our country. We'll have a bit of discussion up here. We'll open up to the floor. There's this kind of fixed mic if you're upstairs. You have to go to the mic. And we'll have roving mics downstairs. Our panel for this is Billy Bragg, musician, activist, a Remainer. Campaigned in one event with Jeremy Corbyn. Which side was he on, actually, Billy, in that event?
This is a media distortion of the reality right, that I lived.
Okay, cool. You will tell us. Next to Billy, Alp Mehmet, who's from Migration Watch, former diplomat, and in his personal capacity, a Brexiteer. But he's not... Migration Watch, which campaigns for controlled immigration... Migration Watch didn't actually take a position officially in the referendum. Suzanne Evans, third in there, was deputy chair of UKIP until Nigel Farage thought she was too much of a threat and had her suspended from the party, but that's a whole different story, and that's not the real view of it. That's not his line of it. But, no, was suspended and is, was UKIP deputy chair, has been a long-standing, was a long-standing member of the party until she was suspended. And last and not least, Torsten Bell at the end, who is director of the Resolution Foundation, which is a think tank that's come from nowhere to sort of 80 miles per hour in a very short period of time and specialises in kind of analysing living standards, wages, benefits, the interaction of them, and sometimes gives the Institute for Fiscal Studies a run for its money. Okay, we're going to have 2 minutes from each of you on the divisions. Billy, we're going to put you first.
Thank you very much. Well, the last month or so, I've been trying, like everybody else, to work out what Brexit means outside of just the fact that we're going to leave the European Union. What does it mean to our country? Where the divisions have arisen? And it's very—I think it's very difficult to discern. I don't think it's north-south or old-young, these kind of things. And all I can really talk about with any experience is what happened in the town where I come from, where my family live, which is the London Borough of Barking and Dagenham, which was one of the few London boroughs that voted by 2-1 to leave the European Union. Now, the three issues that were very important to people during the referendum were the economy, immigration and sovereignty. Now, Barking and Dagenham has a real issue about the economy. When I left school in 1974, 40,000 people worked at the car factory there, worked at Ford's in Dagenham. Now, only 4,000 people work there and don't make cars, they just make engines. And as a result of that, house prices in Barking and Dagenham are the lowest in Greater London, possibly the lowest in the South East. As a result of that, there's been a huge influx of people, mostly people from Africa, actually, in Barking and Dagenham, coming to live there, which put incredible pressure on social services, on schools, on doctors' waiting lists. Now, the underlying story there it also involves the huge changes that people have seen in Barking and Dagenham. It's gone from being a 20 years ago, 99% white borough to now something around 80%. And these are real genuine concerns, legitimate concerns that the people have there. But the real problem is the loss of manufacturing jobs. And although people talk a lot about immigration, I think if all of the immigrants were taken out of Barking and Dagenham, I don't think this would bring Henry Ford back. The real bottom line problem there is for the last 30 years, we have ceded power to the markets, to the bond markets. And the other issue that flows into that, obviously, is one of sovereignty. If we're only concerned about our sovereignty with the European Union, it starts to look like we've got a thing about foreigners. Our sovereignty, really, the real problem with our sovereignty is that we've leased it to the global markets. And I feel that the vote in places like Barking and Dagenham was a vote against globalisation rather than a vote against immigration. It was a vote for people who feel that nobody stands up and speaks for them. The Labour Party have been in power in Barking and Dagenham since 1931 when the borough was formed, cut out of Essex. And if you have any other vote there, it goes straight in the bin. Likewise, where I come from in Dorset, the Tories have been in power since 1886. My Labour vote goes in the bin. And until we do something about this, until we make people in places like Barking and Dagenham feel that their voice is heard and their legitimate concerns are addressed, I think we're going to continue to have a divided society.
Can I just ask you, Billy, are you saying that we should have done something that would have kept Ford cars being made there? I mean, because obviously we have a very continental-wide car production thing. We get cheaper cars probably as a result of that.
Yeah.
So people elsewhere in the country can afford cars who may not afford cars otherwise. But I'm just wondering what your actual point is about what you would do for Barking if you were...
My actual point is that rather than allow the market to decide for what's best for Barking, to allow the people of Barking to decide what's best for their borough, I think too often politicians of all parties have said, well, you know, this is just the market. We can't do anything about this. Where really, if we had the will, we could do something
about
it. Not necessarily
what would you do? Because I mean, I understand it would be nice for them to have more control over the destiny, but I just wonder what that would actually mean.
Well, just an example of what it would actually mean is that, you know, we live on an island where the wind blows a lot. So starting to make water turbines and windmill turbines would use the same sort of engineering skills that used to be put in there in Barking and Dagenham. Obviously, if Fords want to move somewhere else, that's their business. But we've really got to look at a way of making globalisation work locally. Too much of the decision-making and the economic power is centralised. And one of the big problems about that, I think, is that although there's been devolution to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, there's been no devolution right. to England. The only election I get to vote in that's in any way proportional, ironically, of course, is the European Parliament election, which sadly has been taken away from me.
All right.
I don't live in London.
Billy,
I live in Dorset.
Yeah. OK, next, Alp.
Thank you. First thing I would say is that were we to have an audience here that represented England, by and large, some of Wales as well, then it would be the other way round. Instead of 80-20, as you suggest, for Remain, it would have been the other way round for Exit. That
would have been
me,
55-45, wouldn't it, really?
Hold on a moment. Nine of the regions, only Scotland, London and Northern Ireland actually voted right. for yeah. Remain.
Not all London.
Not Barking.
Apart from Barking.
Very sensible.
Anyway, you can make a point.
Listen, hold on, yeah. Well, if you let me, I'll make my point. The fact is that most people in England, certainly, voted to come out. I think it's patronising to suggest that they didn't know what they were doing, that they were misled, that they were somehow mistaken in their interpretation of what was going on, and that's why they did it. I think that is a mistake to suggest that. For me, there were a number of messages, but the one for me that was loudest was that mass immigration, and I emphasise mass immigration, is way, way beyond what is sensible, what is in everyone's interests. They would like to see that come down. The present scale of immigration generally means that within 8 years we're going to have a population of 70 million. 20 years after that, it'll be 75 million. So within a relatively short time, we're going to have another city the size of London. That is not sensible. What I would say now is let's accept it, let's get on with it, let's have a proper, sensible negotiating position that is going to give us what we want. Okay. One final point. A certain ex-prime minister said in November 2014 that in 7 years, in 10 years, our population increased by 7%. No country had ever seen such a movement of people in post-war, peacetime Europe. A small island like ours, he said, cannot absorb such numbers at such speed without large public disquiet. That was John Major. I agreed with him then, I agree with him now.
And just a quick follow-up. I mean, there are those on the Leave side who have said it wasn't immigration that was the primary concern. Are you nodding your head,
yes.
Suzanne? Yeah. And I just, what do you say to those who say it wasn't? Everywhere you went, it was taking back control that was the phrase that was the one that grabbed attention. It wasn't we're overrun by foreigners.
Well, taking back control may be, but part of it was in order to have control over immigration. And the fact is that you went around the country, as I did, as everyone did, talking to people. Most people, to me, said either they were going to come out or stay in. But a lot of those who said, I'm going to vote Remain, also said, actually, my heart tells me to do something different. And I would argue that if they would if they had allowed their heart to control what they'd voted, the vote for Brexit may have been even larger.
We've got two theories as to what the vote was telling us. We've got the kind of protest against globalisation, the immigration being the event. Suzanne, why don't you go next?
Thank you, Evan. Well, your original question was, what have we learnt from this vote? And I think the first thing we've learnt is that the British spirit triumphs. It's indefatigable. And optimism actually triumphed. Optimism for a country, a future for Britain, as a country that can go it alone, that can stand on its own two feet and be strong, outrode the majority over public fear, fear, about what would happen if we left the European Union. And I think that optimism has so far shown to be right. Armageddon hasn't happened. The economy hasn't collapsed. Yes, there's been some uncertainty, but we on the Leave campaign always acknowledge that. We said there are risks of staying in as well as risks of leaving. And you look at what's happening now. I think by the time we do leave the European Union, we will have trade deals ready to be signed with some of the world's economic powerhouses. Countries like India, like China, like the USA, countries that the EU has been desperately trying to sign trade deals with a very long time, but has failed. I think the other thing we've learnt is, you remember that phrase, it's the economy, stupid. I think that's been proved wrong. Everybody felt this referendum would be judged on its economic arguments and who would win those, but in fact it wasn't. And as we've just been talking about, the British people actually decided that the issues of sovereignty were far more important, and that was the majority of reasons given in polls as to why people voted to leave the European Union. So I think that's good, that the majority of us think that there are some things that are more important than money, and democracy is definitely one of them, being able to make our own laws. So I'm very heartened by that. Less heartened, personally, by the fact, as Alf intimated, that there are some who don't like democracy when you don't get the answer that you want. A couple of other final observations. It looks as though we've learned that people don't believe experts anymore, and particularly not economists, and that, to go back to what I said originally, they certainly won't trust experts when they seem to have vested interests, putting their own interests forward and trying to frighten you into voting another way. And finally, perhaps a more tongue-in-cheek comment, I think we've learnt that referendums can take down prime ministers. I think perhaps we should have more of them.
Suzanne, I mean, I'm sort of reading into, I'm trying to find what we've got. It was an anti-globalisation vote. It was an anti-immigration vote. Your pitch really is that it was an anti-elite expert establishment vote. Is that right? Is that your belief?
I think it was very much that too, but I think it always was. You know, the main slogan, which worked very effectively with the Leave campaign, is let's take back control. Mm. It's about losing control. It's about, for me, it was about the fact that I want to vote into power the politicians who I can then vote out at the ballot box if they screw up. And the European Union had gradually taken over huge policy areas. Almost the only things that we had full control of left in this country in the EU were the NHS and education. And the EU was even trying to get its sticky fingers onto those. So it's about taking back control, being able to vote into power the people that make our laws, vote them out if they screw up. That, for me, was the most important thing. And as I said, polling showed that was the most important thing.
Do you trust experts, Suzanne? They say
an ex is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure, don't they? So I think, you know, you look at some of the economic experts that were on the Remain side, they got just about everything else wrong. They didn't predict the 2008 crash. They had made a failed prediction after failed prediction. So I think, of course, it's sensible to listen to experts, but what this referendum showed for me is that British people were sensible enough to realise when the experts were experts who'd got it wrong in the past and therefore possibly couldn't be trusted as much as they might like to think they should be.
Well, we're going to go to an expert sitting next to you now.
Exactly. It's like, that was the best intro of all time. It's all, we're not going to defend in principle. It's always nice to go straight from, hi, I run an economics think tank, to then be told that experts know nothing. It's amazing that any experts out in public after the last few months. But anyway, look, so I run an economics research institute, and economics, as Billy has said, and culture, partly as Alf has said, are key factors in what's happened over the last month. But I'm doing something different today. I think I'm the youth rep. So I'm going to talk a bit about what is going on with the age divide in the vote. And look, if you look at what happened on the 23rd of June, it's certainly clear that age mattered. That it mattered by individuals. So on the data we have by individuals' voting patterns, 75% of the under-25s voted to remain. 60% of the over 65s voted to leave. Actually, no region of Britain voted to leave as strongly as the under 25s voted to remain. So that age is definitely doing something in here. Now, the tipping point is around 45. But once you hit 45, not only do you have a midlife crisis, but you also, on average, start voting leave rather than remain. You may or may not think they're connected. I'll leave you to judge. But the so age does matter. Right, on place, age also matters, not just individuals. So even compensating for, you know, the fact that there's how the individuals voted, if you live in a place where more people are old, your area as a whole is more likely to have voted to leave. And actually, if you're in an area with a large number of students, even after taking into account all other relevant considerations insofar as we can, you're still disproportionately as an area likely to have voted for remain. So both at the individual level and at the place level, it matters what age people are and what an age of place feels like. In some ways, you're like, well, that's not exactly massively surprising, but it does tell us a bit about a generational divide in the country. Now, why might it not be surprising? Well, the young are obviously used to travelling more, and part of the debate about the EU is obviously about ease of travelling, and they're also more connected. What they think of as normal in terms of communications between countries and interactions and is just different. And so that's part of it. There is also a basic thing. So I said to you that 45 is the tipping point when you have your crisis and then you start voting for leave. But it is also the point at which you weren't born when Britain joined the EEC. So if you weren't alive in an era where we have been a country that wasn't part of a European collective organisation of this sort, you're probably more likely to think that world is a possible world to live in. So that's, you know, part of what is going on. Now, now a lot of the debate about the youth is about, you'll have seen all the stuff saying, why didn't they bother turning out? It's their own fault. They didn't, you know, they only lost by 4%. They'd bother turning out, they'd have got that. And you might have seen a lot of figures that were being bandied around in the days after the vote saying only 36% of those under 25 bothered turning out. See, now, what that number is a lie. So that number is based on some poor little statos inside Sky News accidentally using the wrong study, which was actually based on turnout in the 2015 general election. So that's not true. What is true is that we, as far as we know, because obviously there was no exit poll, you all have noticed, there wasn't the normal thing you get at 10 o'clock at night, and my background is in party politics, so I'm used to the joy and angst of exit polls at 10 p.m. That didn't happen this time, obviously. You had to stay up till kind of 2, 3 to get a better result. But the exit poll is what normally tells us what the turnout rate was by age. That didn't exist, so we don't really know. The best data we have is that it's about 65% turnout for the under 35s, and that is only about 8% lower than the average. So, you know, insofar as they didn't turn out as well as they might, but they didn't turn out. They did turn out compared to a normal general election. And actually, unlike most general elections since 97 is the tipping point when the young stop bothering voting, really. Before that, they're not that different. After 97, they stop voting compared to the old. But in general, they turned out more for this vote than they have for most general elections. Now, just two other brief points. One on this 16 and 17-year-olds issue, i.e., if they'd all been allowed to vote, it would have been a stonking victory for Remain. Again, that falls into the not counting problem. There aren't enough 16 and 17-year-olds, it wouldn't have made a difference. You can then think it's a good or bad thing, but it wouldn't have changed the result. And secondly, this thing about age and generational divide isn't just about the individuals concerned. So if you are a Leave voter, which is where we should get onto some of this optimism, not optimism, question about Britain. If you're a Leave voter, you by a margin of 60 to 40% think that most children in Britain today are going to have a worse life than their parents. And the flip side is true for Remain voters. So even it's not just about the young. Right, now, conclusion, where does all that leave us? One, the results in, let's not get overexcited about arguments about some people's votes being worth more than others, you know, although clearly the people that didn't get the result they wanted are going to be the ones living with it for more years on average, because obviously people die at different ages. Secondly, though, there is a generational divide in our country, and it is reflected in increasingly both in economics and in cultures. And that is not a good thing, because in the end, societies like families are collective organisations for sharing risk and supporting each other through the generations, and we don't want that divide getting any bigger. Thirdly, look, government can't do everything to sort that, but they could at least stop making it worse. So we can't undo this vote. Why don't we try building some houses so that the young don't think that we're aiming to stuff them over? And if you look what Theresa May has inherited in terms of tax and benefit plans from David Cameron, if those go ahead over the next 4 years, they will take £1.7 billion from the millennials. They're the people born between 1980 and 2000. And give £1.2 billion to the baby boomers. Now, whatever else you think about those tax and benefit plans, that is probably not, this isn't the best time.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
To have policy that exacerbates the generational divide.
Although I see many in the room here will probably welcome such a distribution. But, Thorsten, in a sentence, and I mean a sentence, a lot of what we've been talking about, or we're going to talk about in a second, is about inequality and winners and losers from globalization. I just want you to give us the facts on income inequality over the last 30 years, because I think there's a sort of a view that it's just been a straight line of increasing inequality. But is it as simple as that?
So when it comes to inequality, it shares something in common with bad music, which is that it's all about the 1980s. So inequality basically structurally increases during... Not you, Billy.
Billy!
It's fine. You've kept going. It's not your fault, mate. What do you want?
You mean Spandau Ballet, don't you?
I mainly mean Spandau
Ballet.
But we are all going to have to take our responsibility for Billy for what happened during what was a terrible 10 years for Britain. Now, So inequality basically structurally increases, basically actually straight across the 1980s in a large way, and then it more or less, although there are important changes, but it more or less stays constant across the rest of the 30-year period Evan raises, except that the very well-off in society in Britain across the late 90s and 2000s did carry on pulling away. So the big inequality is a 1980s phenomenon. But if you were really rich, it was a good time to be really rich in the 90s and the 2000s.
I just wanted that line. So I want to sort of summarise. I want to know whether the unifying thing of all of your presentations, whether it's a bit anti-establishment, we don't like experts anymore, we're not going to be told how to behave, we don't like Jean-Claude Juncker, we don't like immigration and the uncontrolled level we've seen it. We don't like globalization. Is the simplest way of caricaturing the vote as one that broadly was one about winners and losers from the economic system that has prevailed over the last 20 or 30 years? I mean, is that the kind of the best way of looking at the division our country has and what the vote told us, Billy?
I think it is, because I think that's why the slogan "Take Back Control" was so powerful. Because if your sort of hopes of the future, economic and social, have been sort of derailed by forces beyond your control, then the sense of not being heard, of not being able to elect people that represent you, or that, you know, whether it's a centralised state that you live in, if you live in England, or technocrats are coming from Europe. That idea, I think, that's why it resonated so powerfully.
Yeah, and now, would you buy that there is a lot of that going on in this vote? I know you think immigration is it, but would you not agree that the correlation between fears of immigration or discontent with it are often in the areas where people feel the economic opportunity isn't there for them?
I wouldn't like to say that. I'm not saying that the whole reason why people voted out was immigration. Right. I made that point. There are a variety of reasons. Immigration not anti-immigration, they just want less of it. Yeah. That was clearly a very powerful message that came out. But there are all sorts of other things. I'm from the part of London that Billy's from, despite what I sound like now. A lot of my East End friends, kids that I grew up with who live elsewhere now, some of them in leafier parts of England, a lot of them were saying to me, look, I am proud to be English. I really feel strongly about being English. Now, my wife is Welsh. She's proud to be Welsh. That's okay. There are those who are second generation Indian, Pakistani, whatever, who are very proud to be Pakistani or Romanian or whatever. However, the moment you say, I'm proud to be English, somehow that's bigoted and that is somehow racist. They resent that.
Right.
And that is a very powerfully felt feeling around.
So there's an identity issue, which you're saying is beyond mere economic
That's
advantage
one of them.
Or disadvantage.
Yeah. This is
but would you disagree if I said a lot of this, at least, was about the kind of the winners and losers from the economic system of the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, clearly, if people were happy, were desperately happy
they
about what was going
change.
On, they wouldn't vote for change.
Yeah. Suzanne, you agree with it, don't you? I'm going to put this to the audience in a second.
I'm not sure you can make quite such a wide generalisation. I mean, I was on the campaign trail, obviously, and it was people from all walks of life who were voting Leave. It certainly wasn't the elites that were voting Remain and the non-elite that were voting Leave. That might have broken down like that in a majority, but that's not the sense that I got on the streets, really. In fact, a friend of mine was at Ascot, and he told me he went into the gents' loos, and he got a vote Leave thing on his hat, which I didn't think you're allowed to do, but anyway, he had a little one. And he said everybody in the loo was saying, yeah, great, vote Leave, fantastic. So, you know, if the people that go to Ascot are the elites in society, most of the people that he met there were actually voting to Leave. So I don't think it breaks down quite that simply.
We don't want to reduce it too much to this, but
No, I think there's always a danger with anything of trying to reduce it to its lowest common denominator to get a nice soundbite for the telly, and you can't always do that. Sorry.
Torsten, would you agree with my summary of it?
Helpfully, we have a lot of data on why different areas voted as they did. So we do, I think on some of this, you know, it's good. We're all anti-experts, I know, so I'll try and minimise the expertise here. But there is like a basic, like we're stating some facts here as if they are like definitely givens, but they're not. We do know on some of these things what was driving the vote. Like we know on migration, it's not to do with the level of migration in particular areas. Actually, the level of migration, how many literally numbers of people there are, actually, if you have more migrants, you're more likely to have voted for Remain. Only a little bit, but you're more likely. You're definitely not doing the other way. What matters on migration is where there were areas that had small numbers of migrants in the past and saw large, not absolute numbers, but large percentage increases in migration flows over the course of the last 10 years, there is a direct correlation with who voted to Leave. So that's Lincoln, Gravesend. These are places that didn't have big migrant populations in the mid-2000s and now don't have large. They're not like Bethnal Green on the way out towards Dagenham. They're not even like Dagenham.
And Lincoln have got very Boston, large immigration populations. Clacton as well.
So Boston is an exception, but Boston's a very special case. But on most of those areas, they do not have in absolute terms large migrant populations. Those tend to be in the big cities. What they had was no migration
Birmingham
until
out.
Yeah, no. Much look, the West Midlands surprised? Actually, interestingly, the Midlands is actually Leave Central.
Too?
It's not the North, the Northwest, and the Northeast. Actually, once you control for everything else, are less likely to have voted Leave. The Midlands is the Leave powerhouse on this vote. But on the macro question, which is this about globalisation and is it about a system that doesn't work for everyone? That is definitely a large part of it. But the only thing we should be careful about is it's not about recent changes over the last 10 years when most of Britain has been seeing a pay squeeze. Most of Britain has done pretty badly over the last 10 years. Some areas have done really badly. The young have done really badly. That is not driving the vote. What is driving the vote is deep-rooted pay differences between parts of the country. If you are a poor area and you were poor back in 2000, you are much more likely to have voted Leave. It's to do with the underlying structure of our economy, not to do with temporary changes.
I want to throw to you, but I just want to ask one question. Billy, I'm particularly interested in your opinion on this. I want to be the first one to throw this into the mix. There's been a lot of concern on the left about inequality and growth of inequality. I want to suggest, hypothesis, not opinion, obviously, that spatial inequality, it's not about the number of rich and the number of poor. It's about a sense in some areas that if you're born in that area, you can't get a decent job in London because you'll never be able to afford to move in there. And there are no jobs in your area. And it's this spatial inequality that is the problem that has fueled a lot of people feeling like they have no, they have no stake. So Britain, on the whole, in the post-industrial age, hasn't performed strikingly badly. No. I mean, the economy's in fact grown pretty well since the 1980s. Per capita GDP is up. Inequality, as we heard, hasn't changed that much since the kind of the first ravages of it all in the 1980s. And yet, somehow the discontent feels to have got more intense. And I just wonder whether it's about geographical inequalities rather than personal.
Well, it's definitely true that there's an imbalance economically between London and the South East and the rest of Britain, or I'd say the rest of England, because I think Scotland, because of devolution, Scotland and to some extent Wales and definitely Northern Ireland, have been able to make their own economic weather, whereas areas of like the West Country where I come from, the North East, North West, they are really still having to deal with it, hence the George Osborne's attempts to bring in the city devolution to try and decentralise some power away. And I think if you were able to do that, if devolution in England, for instance, was obviously an English Parliament would just make London's power even bigger. But if you had regional assemblies, most of the English regions are the same size as Scotland, therefore they have the same kind of tax base. If they had Holyrood powers, they would be able to work on their own kind of economic ideas and generate, perhaps by working together with other regions, to rebalance the English economy with regard to London and the South East. Yeah. So I think you're definitely onto something there.
Can I just ask, how many people here would favour some kind of regional assemblies or regional parties? As one of the responses to this, of sort of how many people are in favour of English devolution, if you like, on a sort of... How many people would be against English devolution? Say again? Well, OK, I'm giving you English regions. How many of you would favour an English parliament, say in Manchester, the English parliament doing health, schools, police and that kind of stuff, all the English stuff. How many would favour an English parliament in Manchester? And how many would be against another parliament? Yeah, it's not very, very well developing. OK, look, I want to take some questions, comments.
Evan, can I just add one thing, actually, on this?
Go on,
So on this inequality thing, like we know the answer on whether inequality within a particular area affected the vote, and the answer is it didn't. So if there are more... A simple level of inequality within a particular geographical area does not lead to more people voting to leave or to remain. Then it is the level... It's the geographical spatial differences between areas that matters.
But it's the sense in some areas. I mean, mostly one would say the post-industrial areas or the coastal towns that haven't seen much, a sense that they see what's going on in London and the booming parts and the sense of...
Yeah, you should be careful. None of that explanation works for any of the gin-drinking Tory shires at all.
No. And so
it turns out there's a lot of gin being consumed, so
The Tory shires is very different. That's very different. OK, we're going to take a few comments and questions. We've got some roving mics. I can't see the rovers. Yes, there's one here. We'll take this gentleman in the second row here, and then we'll take a guy in the second from the back over there. I think you've got glasses and a check shirt. Yeah, but we'll take you first, sir.
Right. Is it working? Yes. Suzanne, the smiling assassin. I've listened to your jingoistic...
You're the smiling assassin.
I've been listening to your jingoistic and incorrect assertions. Quite nonsensical, I might say.
Just keep it brief, sir. What's your point?
Well, first of all, I'd like to challenge some of the points she made. She made the point that nobody saw the crash coming. Totally incorrect. People did see it. And let me give you a good example. Mr. Carney made his name in Canada by seeing the 2008 crash coming. He adjusted the Canadian economy to allow it. And Canada, as a result, did much better than most other countries in fighting that recession. And he is the man that we paid masses of money over to here to guide our economy that you personally rubbished. The expert. He was a man who saw it.
Thank you, sir.
Nobody saw it. And we pay him an inordinate amount of money, by the way, too much in my opinion.
Point made. Thank you. Can we take the guy at the back over there? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is to the entirety of the panel, which is actually, what do you think about the impact that British government policy has
had on... Can you just put
the
mic closer to your mouth?
Yeah, okay. So the major point here that I'm trying to make is, if you actually think about the impact of migration, it's not actually migrants itself that seem to be the problems in a lot of areas. It's actually the government response to dealing with this migration that seems to be the really pertinent issue. It's not the fact, oh no, we can't deal with these numbers. It's the fact that we actually can deal with these numbers in a lot of areas, but there is woefully substandard policy. And actually, we've sort of bogeymanned the European Union as being to be... to blame for this, but really there should be a sense of, you know...
Can I just ask, what would be the policy that, you know, what should we have done that we didn't do?
So, for example, in the area of the country I come from, West Yorkshire, there is a significant cultural, political, social, economic divide between the British Asian community and what is seen as the native British community, if such a thing actually exists. And the idea is that you need to look for greater community engagement. And I think that local councils and actually metropolitan councils and the national government could have done a lot more to invest in those sorts of areas. And I actually think a lot of the fuel for the fire that parties like UKIP and the anti-establishment parties have gained is actually a response to the failings of the British government for the last 30 or 40
Point
years.
Well made. Alp, do you think if we'd coped better with migration... we would probably have a country more at ease with it.
That's the whole point, Evan, that we couldn't cope with it because of the scale of it. There was no concern about immigration in the 19... There was relatively little concern about migration in the 1990s. With regard to EU migration, it's only in the last 3 years or so that it's actually become significant and got to the point when it does... bring about the sort of pressures that lead to the concerns that people have voiced.
The last 3 years, but you had Migration Watch has been going for a decade or more, hasn't it, campaigning against migration? I said
EU migration. EU migration has all but doubled in the last 3 years.
The terrible irony in all that is that Margaret Thatcher insisted that the former Eastern Bloc countries came into the European Union so that they could act as a counterweight against the United Germany. And now, it was Thatcher initially who wanted to push for them to come in after the Berlin Wall came down because she was afraid of United Germany. And the terrible irony is now that through our plebiscite, we have now left the European Union and Germany rather reluctantly has no choice but to take that role that Margaret Thatcher was so afraid of.
More questions. We've got a lady down here next to the... aisle, and I'm looking for other women. Yeah, and then we'll take the lady in the middle over there, yes, with a green pen in her hand. Yes, you start, and then we'll keep the green pen in the air so the mic can come to you. There we are. Go. In front of your mouth. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Is that good? My question is slightly different. It is and it isn't covered by your debate. I have to conclude that what I learned from the referendum is that people, including the media, including the public, and including the MPs, did not understand it, that there is no mandate for Brexit, and that is because it was an advisory referendum. What follows an advisory referendum is that it goes to government and they take it as one consideration amongst many, and that includes amongst considering the young in the country who cannot vote. And what is in the interests of the people. And if you look at mandatory referenda for constitutional change, they would require a supermajority. The Tory party requires a two-thirds majority. The Tory party had no right to assume directly after the vote that Brexit has won. Because in fact, if you take all the considerations, the status quo...
Thank you. I think your point's been well made, and I think we're very, very, very aware of it. Lady with the green pen, and then we'll go to a gent right at the back in the white shirt. Yes,
sorry, my point rather follows on from the point of the previous lady, actually, because in my view, this is the most important decision in the national interests of the United Kingdom, not England, Scotland and Wales. I'm a member, I'm British. And this is the most important decision in the national interest of the United Kingdom since the end of the Second World War. Now, any government minister of state would not have the temerity to make such a decision without considerable briefing papers from professional, objective civil servants, which would contain evidence-based arguments from experts for the pros and cons of making such a decision. And no such person, Suzanne, would have the temerity to make a decision without looking at those. How so then can you expect the British public to make a decision without being adequately and properly informed?
Thank you. I think we've got the question.
Suzanne, like...
Can I stop you? Because I don't want us to get too involved. I was going to ask this, actually, when we do the programme later. I don't know if any of you read Matthew Paris's piece in The Times today.
Yes.
It's a very good piece. It's basically about a lot of you in the room here, grieving Remainers. And he's saying, it's time to move on. You've got to accept the result. And I just wonder... Wait. How many of you... Wait. Matthew Paris is a very passionate Remainer, by the way. He's a very passionate Remainer. I just want to know, how many of you who voted Remain... I'm going to give you a choice. Don't put your hand up yet. How many of you believe you must accept the result and make the best of it, which for him is, by the way... the closest thing to EU that you can get in the world of Brexit, rather than any of the harder versions. So how many of you, in a minute, how many of you think we need to make the best of it, and how many of you still think we should try and reverse it? So how many of you would like to make the best of Brexit, and how many of you think the emphasis should be on trying to reverse it?
Well, that's encouraging.
Or not do it. Yeah. Okay. So it's about, I'd say, a little bit more for making the best of it. We might have a bit of discussion on that in the live program. Right. I'm going to take the gent in the white shirt. It looks white from here, right at the back. And
upstairs.
Oh, sorry. I'll tell you what. We'll take upstairs first. Sorry. I've been looking at that mic. There was no one at that mic, and I didn't. There isn't a mic there. It's over there. Okay. We'll take the one upstairs. Then we'll take you, sir. Yes. Go ahead.
My question sort of simply boils down to, would we have exited if we hadn't had austerity? The broader point I'd like to make is, I think it was a perfect storm that's been waiting for us for about 20, 25 years. A combination of a dislocation of most of us from mainstream politics, and this is partly a bloody nose for the political establishment, austerity, and that's the real problem with communities that are suffering. It's not about blaming the migrant. It's about the unregulated housing sector. It's about the pressure on wages. It's about companies who are still allowed to hire workers from abroad and pay them less than they would if it were recruiting local people to those jobs. And I think it's about 20, 25, 30, 35 years of blaming everything on Brussels. And finally, so this is to all the panel, our presenter included, it's about a pretty pitiful performance from the media. Because with the exception of Newsnight, with the exception of Newsnight and a couple of other places, actually most of what we heard was a very, very limited debate. I went to listen to one mainstream political leader give a speech, pretty good speech, quite interesting. He was a Remain and reformer. I came back to watch BBC News to see the coverage of the speech, and instead I got 1 minute and 45 seconds of Boris Johnson auctioning a cow in a common agricultural policy stunt. Now, if we think that informs us, it just doesn't. So I think this perfect storm of dislocation from politics, austerity, a poor performance by the media, and a bloody nose to the Brussels people we've been blamed for everything for the last 30 years, that's what did it.
Thank you very much. I'd like you to keep your intervention short. We've got a whole afternoon, so there will be plenty of time for... Torsten, I want to ask you, I don't know, is there any data? So the clearest... untruth was the 350 million, wasn't it? I mean, it was simply there was no 350 million. Yeah. Is there any data as to whether people actually believed it? Everybody knew about it.
Yeah.
Do we know whether people believed it? Because I think people probably didn't believe it. I mean, we told them innumerable times not to believe it, and I would imagine they didn't believe it.
I'm not sure it matters if they... I mean, did they believe in pounds and pence they were going to get £350 million a week for the NHS? Almost certainly not.
That would be my view.
Were they aware that one side was pushing an argument that there would be some more money for the NHS if they stopped these Brussels bureaucrats sucking all? Yes, and the fact that there was a row about whether it was true or not,
yeah.
actually made the message much more powerful than a straight reporting of was it true or not. I mean, you know, so my background is in party politics. There is definitely something has happened. Two things have happened to our media class, which are affecting some of what you're talking about in terms of how politics is reported. One is that they've lost their bottle, in particular slightly the BBC, which is they're much more reluctant to say one side saying this, one side saying this, but really the fact is like Z. They're much more likely to have a package which is 30 seconds from one politician saying, you know, the sky is black, another one says the sky is blue, and they're like, who knows, it's black or blue, 50-50. Although the reason they do that, though, is because they are aiming for impartiality. So they have lost their confidence. The elite in Britain, actually, for all the idea that the elite is very powerful nowadays, actually, collectively, it's lost its bottle, basically, more or less.
Okay. Did you want to talk, Al? Very quickly, because we've got another 2 minutes,
Khrushchev said that a politician is someone who says they will build you a bridge even where there's no river. I think people are well aware of the fact that there are distortions, there are all sorts of exaggerations in these sort of campaigns. My question to our friends here is, had the a result gone the other way...
Don't ask this one, because we're going to get into a very... I know where you're going.
Who would have said this is grossly unfair?
It's a good question.
I doubt that many would.
It's a good question. Don't answer. Don't rise, because we don't want to go. I'm going to take the gentleman at the back there very quickly, and then we're going to close.
Hello, yes, thank you. I had two comments to make.
One, please. Just pick your best one, because we haven't got much time.
Okay. In answer to the lady down there who said that the referendum was advisory, that is true. Parliament does have the final sovereignty. However, there is a higher sovereignty, and that is the people's sovereignty, and the people have spoken.
And you're a Brexiteer who want us to accept the result.
I did hundreds of hours of work in Westminster Tower.
Yeah. Okay.
Ever before voted in this referendum. Yeah. I think that says something about, as the lady was saying, how significant, both of you were saying, how significant a decision that is. And I think we got that point across. It was far more than significant than any general election, because it's about who governs Britain. And the British people overwhelmingly decided they didn't want the European Union governing Britain any longer.
Wait, please.
When you say overwhelmingly.
We're going to end. I'm going to give Billy Bragg the last word, but not the word you wanted, Billy. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think Brexit will do anything to heal the divisions that we've talked about around winners, losers, young,
no,
old?
No, because the idea of unelected lawmakers will not be applied to the House of Lords. Because the idea of an elite that doesn't listen to anybody will not be applied to the English. You don't have any proportional voting out there. And no, because the idea of taking back control will not be applied to those who have economic power over
us. Last word, Suzanne. Do you think Brexit will heal all the stuff we've been talking around in terms of division?
No, of course it won't, and I'd be the first to admit that. It will give us the power to be able to address some of the issues. But politics is broken. Politics is not going well. You know, there are all kinds of things I'd like to change in politics to make it more honest, to make it more open, to make it more transparent, to make it more democratic. And we've still got an awful lot of work to do in order to achieve that. But that is a whole new other debate.
OK. We're going to leave that first panel there. Can we please thank our four panellists? Agree with them or not?
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates and events for over 2 decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organisation, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.